big, fast-moving show. On Monday, January 27th, Dr. David Banik joined us from the UConn Health Center in Farmington to talk about what we know and what we don't know about the coronavirus. We had a visit from Isabel Blank of the Yankee Institute for Public Policy on a well-received list of recommendations she has put out to the General Assembly in Connecticut, helping Connecticut, she hopes, operate a bit smoother in Hartford. We also heard in the 4 and 5 o'clock hours from Bridgeport Police Chief Armando Perez and Mayor Joe Ganim about a shooting that took place right in front of the courthouse on Golden Hill Avenue earlier in the day. And I kicked off the show with a few of my own thoughts on that shooting and violence in the city. Violence today, we should tell you about in downtown Bridgeport. We had this breaking story for you here with the details on WYCC. This broke right around 12:15 or so. Three people shot this morning, actually early this afternoon, outside the Golden Hill Street courthouse shortly after noon today in Bridgeport. Various releases and notes from the media, this account from the Connecticut Post and the story here by Ethan Fry. They quote a bail bondsman and an eyewitness at the time saying, quote, one car just pulled up to another car and started firing. It was crazy. It was insane. Now, get this. Now, this is not official. This is not coming from the city. This is coming from this Dave Simmons, who was quoted here by the Connecticut Post. Simmons estimating at least 30 shots were fired from three handguns. Wow. 30 shots were fired from three handguns after an SUV pulled up next to the victim's vehicle, a Chevy sedan that sat riddled with bullet holes in front of the courthouse afterward. The windows opened and it just went crazy, Simmons said. Yikes. Outside the courthouse, people were placed on stretchers and loaded into ambulances as officers, state police, state courthouse marshals set up a perimeter around the shooting scene. Rowena White, the city's director of communications, saying three people have been confirmed shot, non-life-threatening injuries. She said, quote, in a release that I'm looking at right here, she said, quote, this is not a random act. This is not an active shooter. Well, yeah, I guess it looks like it's targeted. Mayor Joe Ganim, City Council President Heidi Nieves, as well as council members Anita Martinez, Ernie Newton, State Rep Andre Baker arriving at the scene after the shooting. Council members said Ganim pledged to shut down violence in the city. Good. Nieves said, quote, the plan is to sit with the mayor this afternoon. They're going to have that today, apparently. And the police chief and even the housing authority executive director to create a viable plan to assure the safety of residents living in the area. Nieves tells the Post, this could have been a lot worse as it's an open public area. Could you imagine?
Jeez.
30 shots fired. Thankfully, there weren't that many people on the steps going into the courthouse. Ernie Newton saying we can't tolerate this, calling on the state and the feds to help. Also commenting, Representative Andre Baker saying, quote, it has to be a collaborative effort. It has to be a long-term plan. It has to be something that's consistent, not just something for 4 or 5 months and stops. I agree there. Quote, we have to be proactive instead of reacting to what's going on. Here's what I'm wondering, and you know where I'm going on this. Let's hope, I hope I'm proven wrong here, but I really, 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 honestly hope that we hear from Senators Richard Blumenthal, Chris Murphy, Congressman Jim Himes, because you know what I'm going to say here, folks. If you've heard me for any time here, if you've heard me at other stops I've made around this day doing talk radio, it's very simple. I think urban violence, urban gun violence that we saw today or we heard about today in downtown Bridgeport, and we're still waiting, obviously, for all the facts to be sifted out here. I do have a request in, by the way, I should mention, with the city to hopefully get the mayor on the phone or on the show today, or to get the police chief or somebody on the show to talk about it. I really would like to see Mr. Blumenthal, Mr. Murphy, or Jim Himes, or somebody come out strongly against this, as strongly as they come out against suburban gun violence, when, you know, the alleged gunmen or gunman or whatever, is using a long gun, maybe disturbed or another, and the first words usually out of their mouths have something to do with the NRA and the AR-15 and a perceived stereotype here. So I hope, and I will fully compliment them. I will fully give them all the kudos and applaud, whatever they would need, the applause they would need, if they come out and say, listen, this is something we have to address. Because you know and I know, and I've said this over and over and over and over and over again, not enough is done about urban gun violence in this city. It's not. It's not. Now, we have all these folks like, you know, the city folks, Ernie Newton, all these other people saying, fine, we have to do something about it. Okay, number one, anybody who does this stuff, you put them in jail and you keep them there. You keep them there for a long time. You have to get the message across that making a mistake with a firearm, no matter how old you are, whether you're just barely an adult at 18 or whether you're 28, 38, 48, or 58, you have to send the message that if you pull that trigger, a good chunk of your life will be over. I'm not saying you get killed, you get beaten to death, but you will be inside for a long time. The quickest way to make any city safer, I don't care whether it's Bridgeport, Hartford, New Haven, New York City, whatever, the quickest way, one of the simplest ways to make it safer, is get the bad people off the street. It's not hard. Now, when I say it's not hard, I'm not necessarily saying that from a try and be trite here. I know the process is long. It's detailed, as it should be in a society where we have a specific legal system. But you have to show people, no matter how old they are, no matter where they come from, no matter what race they may be, no matter what gender they may be, you have to show them that if you are going to go down this avenue, there must be harsh, harsh, harsh consequences. Pretty simple. It ain't rocket science. Back here on Connecticut Today, right here on WICC 600 on the radio and online at WICC600.com. We're talking public health, national health, world health. A lot of you folks may be reading about the coronavirus, the outbreak of this pneumonia-like disease that, is spreading in certain areas around the world. Let's get the bottom line here as to what's going on. We welcome back to Connecticut Today, previous guest, Dr. David Banik. He's Associate Professor of Medicine, Head of Infection Prevention, and he's the Hospital Epidemiologist at the UConn Health Center in Farmington. Dr. Banik, Paul here in Bridgeport, thanks for coming back. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Doctor, let me get your initial response and your initial feelings here. When you first heard that the coronavirus was in fact popping up, what was your initial thought?
So, I mean, I think my initial thought was caution. I think we've seen experiences with novel viruses in the past, and by novel I mean a virus that's relatively newly identified in human populations. And we've seen a full spectrum. Some of these viruses can cause mild illnesses, and some of them can be quite dangerous. So, I think caution is always the first instinct when we hear about something new. And then, as the situation evolves, we learn more and more information. I think that helps guide the decisions that we need to make and what to anticipate for the future.
And at a base level here, Doctor, for some of our listeners who might not understand the difference, explain the difference between a viral infection and a bacteriological-based one.
Sure. So viruses and bacteria are two different kinds of microorganisms. So bacteria are larger. They live in our bodies, in our gastrointestinal tracts. They live on our skin, and they're all around the environment around us. They cause bacterial infections, which can range from a very mild infection, like a skin infection, or a much more severe infection if bacteria get into the blood. On the other hand, viruses are much smaller particles. They can be shared either from person to person. The ones we commonly think about are things like the flu virus, organisms that transfer from the respiratory tract. But there are other viruses out there, too, that can be spread either through direct contact or sometimes through blood contact. So they have other mechanisms in that sense as well.
Tougher to treat and diagnose, doctor, one or the other, viruses versus bacteria or not?
I wouldn't say more difficult necessarily. They're different. So we do have microbiology testing for both viruses. In the recent decades, we've been using molecular testing, so actually using genetics to identify viruses in a much more accurate way. Bacteria, we typically identify in the lab by culturing it, so growing it in the lab. And that's a sort of different technique, whereas a lot of the viruses, we really focus mostly on the genetics of the virus to identify them as opposed to trying to grow them.
So let's talk about the basics here, maybe a possible origin, what this looks like to you infectious disease folks. The coronavirus, give us a little primer here on what you're looking at.
Sure. So coronaviruses are actually a family of different viruses. We have coronaviruses that naturally circulate in the community. They are common causes of the common cold, for instance. But there are other coronaviruses that can cause much more severe illness. You'll recall maybe from the early 2000s, the SARS epidemic was actually a coronavirus, and that was a particular virus that had a very high rate of causing severe illness. So that's another type of coronavirus, but coronavirus is kind of the more generalized family that we talk about, much like how we talk about flu viruses, other respiratory viruses in different categories. Coronavirus is one of those classifications that we use to describe a group of viruses. And this particular virus, the 2019 novel coronavirus, falls into that group.
So it sounds like, Dr. Banik, that these family of different viruses have what, similar characteristics, and then they vary in certain ways?
They're similar in their structure. So that's how we classify viruses in the microbiological sense. We look at how their structure, their shape, their size, and that helps us, and their relatedness, actually using genetics, that helps us determine that they're within a family. But in terms of the spectrum of illness they can cause, there is a lot of variation. As I mentioned earlier, some of these viruses cause the common cold, but other coronaviruses, like I said, can cause a much more severe clinical picture.
So this virus itself, now obviously there are just thousands of sources that people can get their news from on a daily basis. However, I did read several stories over the weekend, Dr. Banik, about where did this come from? And we're seeing stories about that it was primarily an animal-borne coronavirus or an animal-based one that may have jumped from reptiles or snakes. Any insight on that?
That seems to be the case from what we're learning about the virus. So when in this particular situation, geographically, it looks like the original cases were from the Wuhan region of China. And it seems that there is an animal connection. Exactly what type of animal, I think, is a little bit unclear. And interestingly, when we look at the genetics of this virus, we see that it's genetically related to coronaviruses that we see in animal populations. So that gives us some further insight that this has some sort of animal origin. Again, we don't know the details of exactly what animal or how it began, but it looks like there is an animal origin to this, although now we're seeing person-to-person spread.
Yeah, so obviously when you think animals, and this might be a complete different branch of investigative work, I'm sure, because I remember during the AIDS epidemic, the origins of that, the question is, was this from ingesting a certain animal meat? Was it from waste material? Was it from a pet situation? That's also, I would assume, going to be investigated here.
Definitely. I think we still have a lot to learn in that aspect of this particular virus, exactly how it went from being in a native animal population and even what animal population that is into the human population.
Okay, so if somehow, Dr. Banik, it gets into a human, what does the coronavirus then do once it finds a human host or a human to latch onto?
So this particular virus causes what we describe as a respiratory illness, so an illness that primarily affects the lungs, the upper airways, and in mild cases can cause a fever, some upper respiratory symptoms, and then in the more severe cases can progress down to a pneumonia, and that's really what leads to patients becoming severely ill. So I think there's a wide spectrum of illness, but it's really predominantly within the respiratory system.
And am I correct, doctor? I have read when the flu was being discussed and other cases like this that oftentimes what is deleterious to the patient is the body's reaction to this, the mass secretion of fluid to battle this. Is that in this case or not?
Difficult to know how specific that is to this particular coronavirus strain. I think we're still learning a lot about the details of how patients become ill in response to exposure, whether it is related directly from the virus injuring the body and causing tissue damage in the body versus that effect of the immune system. I think what you're describing is something that we do see with the influenza virus, that it's actually not just the virus itself, but the body's immune response that causes a lot of the damage and a lot of the severe illness that we see in patients with really severe flu infections. But whether that applies to this coronavirus, I think we're still We're still learning quite a bit about it.
The guest is Dr. David Banik, Associate Professor of Medicine, Head of Infection Prevention at the UConn Health Center. We'll take a break. We'll check traffic and weather together on the Sixes here, and we shall return with more on the coronavirus. Back here on Connecticut Today, Paul Pacelli with you at WICC 600 on the radio and, of course, online 24-7 whenever you want us at WICC600.com. Talking about the coronavirus, you've probably been reading about it over the weekend and such. The guest, Dr. David Banik, he's an associate professor of medicine, head of infection prevention, and the hospital epidemiologist at the UConn Health Center in Farmington. So, doctor, from a battling point of view, you folks in the infectious disease sectors, you see this and you say what? First thing is patient isolation or patient caution, right?
Right. So the first thing that we always think about is the infection control aspects of these viruses. So we want to give our patients who are sick with viruses care that they need, but we also need to think about what we can do to prevent the virus from spreading to others in a healthcare facility, to the healthcare personnel taking care of the patient. So those are really the two forefronts. You know, how do we best take care of these patients while protecting our healthcare providers as well as our other patients that we come in contact that we are serving in our facility.
And I guess it varies, correct, with each virus, each bacteria. We read about, you know, viruses and bacterium where you literally have to have skin-to-skin contact for an extended amount of time versus things that are airborne, correct?
Exactly. And there's even more nuanced detail beyond that. So when we think about infection prevention, we think about how we're going to block the spread either through the air or through direct contact or sometimes through indirect contact. What do we need to do and understand about the particular organism to know how far it spreads? So, for instance, some viruses travel short distances. Some bacteria and viruses can travel for longer distances. So those are really important as we think about infection prevention strategies for each specific organism.
We're reading, doctor, over the past few days, especially on the weekend, that as part of this prevention effort, many airports around the world are doing rough screenings using thermal imaging, using different types of fever detection thermometers and all that. How effective is that, really?
Well, I think there can be a lot of benefit from that. We know that this particular type of virus spreads when individuals are febrile. That's the group that we need to worry about most. So I think doing temperature screening, particularly among populations that were at risk for becoming exposed to the virus, can have some utility in trying to identify people who may be sick with the virus and potentially spread it to other individuals. So I think there is some benefit. I think the implementation to that kind of strategy can be challenging, can be very resource intensive. But in the right circumstance, I think there can be some benefit from temperature screening, and that's really what a lot of airports and other transportation hubs have been using. So I think that, you know, coupled with a lot of public health information, public health oriented information, and of course, basic infection prevention strategies are really essential in trying to prevent this from spreading.
There was a woman doctor who had returned from that area of China a few days ago. I believe it was one of the cases in Chicago. And rather than when she became symptomatic, rather than go to a clinic immediately or go out in a public area or in a walk-in, she phoned her doctor's office first. And the health officials in Chicago are praising her for that. Is that something you would recommend first if somebody has any notion that they may be ill with this?
I think that's actually quite wise. Giving your healthcare provider or your healthcare facility a heads up that you're having these symptoms. You know, what should you use to gauge your decision about whether or not you need to come into care, either through an emergency department or through an outpatient office to get evaluated? But I think that heads up is really so critical to ensure that if you do come in, if that's the recommendation that's made, that adequate preparations are taken in advance to prepare the staff to ensure everything can be done to prevent spreading and infecting other people. So I think that if that opportunity is available to reach out to a provider over the phone to discuss symptoms, and then if you do decide to come in to give sort of a heads up to your provider, I think that's really quite beneficial in the infection prevention aspect of this.
It may, though, be a difficult decision, doctor, for some people who say, okay, maybe I have a little cold, maybe I have a little touch of the flu or just a head cold. What would be the red flags in your mind, as it were, to maybe, although at least now it's still a remote chance, but for some people to maybe say, hey, this might be that? What would you say?
Well, I think that the traveling history is critical. So have you been to a region, particularly the Wuhan region in China, where we're seeing this virus spread quite rapidly? I think that, coupled with the degree of your symptoms, so if you were having fevers and illness to the point where you're concerned about your ability to kind of maintain and sustain okay at home, are really critical pieces of information. But if there's any doubt, I think calling your provider to discuss the circumstance, discuss your symptoms, can help with that triaging decision about whether or not you need to come into the office or to a higher level of care, like an emergency department, to get evaluated is really critical.
What kind of a mortality rate, doctor, are we seeing about this on this? What numbers are you folks seeing?
So I think it's a little early to really give concrete information. We're seeing numbers changing literally every day. You know, I think the mortality rate that we're seeing is, to date, lower than what we've seen with other severe coronavirus infections like SARS. We aren't seeing a mortality rate at that level at this point in time. Granted, that could always change. But, you know, I think it's difficult to really put numbers out there because they're literally evolving every day.
You know, finally, doctor, it was a fascinating story I saw over the weekend that the Chinese have released the DNA sequencing that they found, all the genetic information. And it's amazing that I saw that there's a couple of companies, I think, already in just a few days saying they're pretty close to starting to testing a vaccine for this. How does that happen so quickly? Is it modern technology?
Absolutely. And I think that really shows how far we've come since the time period of SARS, which was, you know, less than 20 years ago. Now that we have genetic information that can be rapidly obtained and disseminated, the dissemination piece is really key. We're really able to jumpstart and accelerate the development of antiviral treatments, vaccinations, and even do contact tracing and virus tracing at a much higher level. So I think that advancement in genetics and technology really does work to our advantage quite a bit when we're thinking about the response when we see a new kind of viral pathogen coming to light.
And final question, Dr. Banik, you folks in the infectious disease area of medicine that watch this, is there a point that you're looking for, whether it's numbers or infection patterns, where you say, okay, we're out of the woods on this, we haven't passed the point of no return?
There is what we call an epidemiology curve. So sort of the point where we no longer see rises of cases and we start to see drop off in the rate of new cases, there is an inflection point there. In terms of the actual number, I think we aren't able to put that number out there just yet. I think once we learn more about the rate that the virus is spread throughout populations, we can start to get a sense of that. I think it's a little premature to start knowing exactly what that's going to look like, but there are ways that epidemiologists do track the trajectory of these kinds of viruses and other pathogens as they spread through the community to know that we're really achieving success in preventing further spread.
Fascinating stuff. Dr. David Banik, Associate Professor of Medicine, Head of Infection Prevention, Hospital Epidemiologist, UConn Health Center in Farmington. As always, Doctor, we do appreciate it. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Bye-bye. You may have seen, in fact, I think I posted it on the WICC 600 Facebook page. There was a list submitted last week by our good friends at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy in Connecticut. Yes, we do have a conservative think tank here in the state. You wouldn't think so, but we do, about some recommendations that have actually been applauded by the Hartford Courant. Even some of the writers on some of the alternative sites here in Connecticut say, hey, these Yankee Institute folks, they may have something here about how to make government better in Connecticut. Joining us right now is the woman who put these policies together, Senior Manager of External Affairs, Isabel Blank for the Yankee Institute. Hey there, Isabel. It's Paul at WICC. How are you?
Hi, I'm great. How are you?
Not too bad, not too bad. It's a pretty good list you have there. I like them. What made you do this? How'd you come up with these?
So it's actually interesting. I've been with Yankee for a year and a half about, so I've seen one legislative session in my time.
And that was enough. That was enough. That's all
exactly.
You needed, right?
Exactly. That's all I needed. but I think just coming in with fresh eyes compared to, you know, people who've been doing this stuff and seeing the legislature for years and years and years, I've kind of been privy to a little bit of what's going on and why maybe we need some sort of a culture change up at the Capitol.
And you probably have talked to some of these people, right, Elizabeth? And you probably said, geez, this, I've seen one session. This, is this the way thing? And they all go, yeah, that's the way it works, right? Right? Is that what you're getting?
Exactly. So, I mean, a lot of people are open to the changes and, I mean, we've seen, you know, actually a lot of good press on our paper, but people don't really question it until you kind of put the questions out there or the different options out there.
Okay, so let's talk about a few of these things. Start running down your list here because they all made eminent sense to me, Isabel. So tell me, like, point number one of all the ones that are on that list, things that you need think change with the General Assembly after watching it for only one session. What's your real key one, do you think?
So personally, they're all amazing because I wrote them, but. Our main focus is on transparency and accountability. So I think a couple really egregious things point back to the rats in the budget implementer.
Yeah.
So basically, whenever we need to pass a budget, there's a giant implementer bill that has to get passed in order for the budget to actually get adopted. And it's super long. And on the day it comes out, you see all of the reporters doing their kind of annual scan for rats in the budget implementer, just looking for whatever could have gotten thrown in there that people would miss. But it could really be anything. And a lot of things get missed just because it's such a huge document. Just how can we trust the government when we not only accept behavior like this, but we expect it to happen in every single year.
Yeah, and you talk about rats, and I guess for people who are the uninitiated here, Isabel, explain what a rat is. First, I've tried to explain to people over the years, the implementer bill is kind of like the key in the ignition. In other words, the budget gets passed, but they have to pass this implementer bill to actually start the car. But when you and I talk about budget rats, We're not talking about little furry creatures here. What exactly are we talking about?
Yeah, so, yeah, just like you said, the way the budget implementer works, it's kind of supposed to be this kind of technical bill that just makes everything fit into place with existing law. And technically everything in the implementer has to pertain to the budget, but there's a lot of room for legislators to kind of slip things in, just like in the legislative session. So it doesn't go through a committee or a public hearing process because, again, it's just supposed to be this really simple, make everything, like you said, turn the key in the ignition. But the budget is often passed late at night because they take forever to get it done. And so legislators can kind of put in some little lines of writing in different parts of this really long document that shouldn't really – they're not really pertaining to just the basic turn the key of the ignition on the budget.
Yeah.
And it's really whatever they kind of want to get done.
So they slip stuff in there that actually ends up costing money, but it didn't go through the budget process.
So it could be totally unrelated to money. It could be anything. It could be a little line from a bill that just kind of died earlier in session. But the reason that things like this get passed is we need a budget, right?
Yeah.
And everyone knows if we didn't pass a budget on time. So legislators are pushed to kind of get a budget passed. And at the point in the process that the budget implementer comes out, everything's kind of gone through the process. So the implementer is going to get passed, and it's really hard to change it at the point that this happens.
Mm-hmm.
So they can slip stuff in knowing that it's probably going to pass, and people might even miss it in the long document.
Sure. Isabel Blank is with us, Senior Manager of External Affairs at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Couple of other common sense things you have in there, Isabel. Once again, one thing you said, which is the thing that us in the broadcast business, we all laugh at, get rid of the overnight sessions and allow some people, right now, Greg, you know, you and I wake up, you know,
yes.
Oh, gee, at 3 a.m, they passed the budget when they were zoned out on pizza and coffee. Get rid of the overnight sessions, you said. And you talked about a set time period to let people actually read what's in these bills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for the overnight sessions, I mean, how great of a decision can you be making when you're voting on something at 3 a.m. or you've been debating a bill for 24 hours straight? We want to create an environment that leads to good decision making in our legislature. So long overnight debates just don't seem to fit into that. But it's done in other states too.
Yeah.
So other states have a set schedule and they have to conclude at midnight and start again the next morning. So it's not unheard of, and they're doing it to themselves by having this exist this way.
Sure. And then the other point you brought up, which has to do with at least a period before anybody can vote on something that the public can actually look at these things, right?
Yeah, definitely. So a lot of language will get updated, at different times, depending on, you know, how it's updated or what part of the process it is. But a lot of that language isn't available to the public in time for a vote. So the only way that you could see the bill language and maybe contact your legislator or talk to someone about it is if you know a lobbyist or a lawmaker themselves, and they can get you the language. I'm a registered lobbyist, and I'm in the Capitol, and even I have trouble getting language sometimes. So to see the everyday person having access to the legislature in this way is just not happening.
Isabel Blank is the guest. She is Senior Manager of External Affairs for the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Isabel, hang on. We'll come back and talk about this more with you. First, traffic and weather together on the sixes here, 416. Isabel Blank is the guest for a few more minutes. She is from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy here in Connecticut. We're at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. She and the folks at the Institute put out a list of common sense changes we should see in how the General Assembly works. You know, Elizabeth, again, The Current has had some favorable things to say. Some other columnists have had some favorable things to say. There was one piece, I don't know if you saw it, I think it was by Susan Bigelow in the Connecticut News Junkie, where she talked laudingly about some of the pieces that you have said, or some of the ideas that you have. She and some other columnists have said, well, part of these problems stem from the fact that it's only a part-time legislature, and the majority of the bills can only get shoved through, jammed through in a six-month session once every 2 years, the long session versus the short session. And at least a couple of them, Isabel, I've read, has said, listen, this is kind of an argument for a longer session or a full-time legislature or a legislature that's more open to common folks. What do you think of all that?
Yeah, so definitely when we wrote this report, we wrote it with the intent of having a large discussion. And I'm so excited to see all of these responses. And I did read Susan's op-ed, and she makes some really good points. And I think that one thing that could come of this report is the creation of a commission to kind of continue discussing some of these ideas. I mean, there's a good and positive and negative side to all the things that she discussed, just like there are to what we've discussed.
And I've always thought that if you went to, and I don't know how the Institute feels about this, whether you folks have discussed this, you know, if you're going to go to a longer session, I've always thought, Isabel, and you're going to make more money. To me, my as much as I detest them on a federal level, it almost seems to me that you would have to go look seriously at term limits. If you're going to pay more money or to go for a longer period of time, you really have to put some sort of buffer up there to make sure that people don't do this as a full-time job for 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah, and I think, you know, whenever you talk about altering the way we're structuring our legislature, you kind of have to see the pros and cons. So one positive of having our part-time legislature is we get people from the community that are, you know, they have other jobs, they're doing other things, but that limits who can hold those jobs, right? What's their part-time job that they get to do, be a legislator the other half of their time? But you could say the same thing for having full-time legislator with term limits. If they can spend 4 years in the middle of their career, what do they do after those 4 years?
Yeah.
So it's always difficult, for sure. It's definitely a conversation we can have, though.
Yeah, and it's really a conundrum because, you know, as a guy told me last week, I was talking about this very thing when, you know, the idea of making the legislature, if not full-time, maybe make it 6 months for each year or 7 or 8 months, structure it like a school teacher. But then again, you know, Isabel, how can the common person, you know, the guy who's not a lawyer or a doctor or a real estate agent who can move around their schedule and weed out some time, how does a plumber or an electrician or a house painter or even a police officer, how do they get the freedom to put their schedule on hold? Nobody's going to do that for a $30,000 a year job. At least I don't think they would.
Right. And I think that since we have a part-time legislature right now, that's a really good point. But we could make it have a much better structure and much more organized than we do now. So other states have it where their session days are planned a year in advance, and they know for the whole year when they'll have to be up at the Capitol. And we don't do that. So even with our part-time legislature like that, you'd expect to have a little more formality to respect the fact that our legislators have other jobs. So it's interesting because you see in some states with full-time legislatures that they have a much more structured and organized setup than we do, and I think we would benefit from that.
Okay, finally, Isabel, is there any feedback that you have gotten from your list of how to make Connecticut's legislature run smoother? Have you gotten any sort of feedback from anybody on either side of the aisle that they may actually look at one or two of these? Has anybody called you or written you or emailed you saying, you know what, thanks for doing this, we may actually entertain one of these?
Yeah, so we've gotten a lot of positive feedback from a couple legislators and a lot of different reporters and different nonprofit groups. I think it's something that could totally be, at least in terms of the creation of a commission, something we see in legislation this session. It's actually been so exciting to see how bipartisan this report has been, and how interest has been on both sides of the aisle, because at the end of the day, we all want a government that's transparent and accountable and accessible to the people.
Absolutely. Isabel, thank you. Isabel Blank from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Good on you. And if any of these things really take off, be sure to get back hold of us. We'll put you right back on. Thanks, Isabel. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bob. Right now is Chief Perez, Bridgeport Police Chief. Chief, it's Paul here on WICC. How are you, sir?
I'm very well. How about yourself?
Not too bad. Chief, can you give us an update, please, for our listeners who may be in their cars just getting out of work right now, may have heard little dribs and drabs here. Tell us about what happened, which I guess happened a little after noontime today at the Golden Hill Courthouse.
Sure. So we had a critical incident which occurred sometime about 12:15 this afternoon, in which two rival groups met in front of the courthouse by chance, and one of the rival groups opened fire upon the other group. There were approximately 20 rounds fired into a vehicle. At that point, three of the individuals that were in the vehicle ran into the courthouse to avoid being shot.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the driver of the vehicle who then managed to exit the vehicle, and he was shot multiple times. So altogether, we had four individuals shot, two that were critical and two that were non-life-threatening. At this time, I'm happy to report that all four individuals have survived. And even though there are two that are critical, they're still going to survive this terrible injury. Sometime later on in the afternoon, we had a good description of vehicles that were involved, and Bridgeport Police Department were able to apprehend three of the individuals that were involved in this by-chance shooting. This was not something that I believe was planned to happen in front of the courthouse. It was something that it was a response to something else that happened the night before.
Wow.
Yeah, so we have three in custody. We recovered a vehicle. The investigation is ongoing. There's another vehicle that we have taken possession of in Naugatuck that was also involved. We later found out. But, yeah, we're on it. And even though that it was something that we don't – I mean, we really, really frown upon this. Our police department did a fantastic job, both patrol and detective division, and the apprehension of these individuals.
So, Chief, and the guest, by the way, here live on WICC on Connecticut Today, Bridgeport Police Chief Armando Perez. So, Chief, yeah. you say that they weren't actually looking for the other group after something happened previously. But so do you think they were just kind of like cruising around and came upon these guys? What do you think?
We don't know. I'll be honest with you. That would be speculating. But the facts are that they did meet, I believe, by chance, because I don't think this was planned to happen in front of the courthouse at Golden Hill Street. They just happened to see each other, and one group opened fire upon the other.
Chief, any of these people, the ones that were wounded or the ones that were shot and you apprehended later on, are any of these individuals known to you and the people in your department?
Yeah, they're very well known to the Bristol Police Department, in particular our gang unit, detective and the Detective Bureau. So it's that 1% that keeps the city busy.
Yeah, you know, I've spoken to other mayors of big cities and here in Connecticut, Chief, in New Haven. John DeStefano always used to say this, even in Hartford, that people have to understand that this does not label an entire city, correct? You have this little, these couple of hundred, depending upon where these people are, that really cause a lot of the violent crime in the city, correct?
You're on point. You're 100% correct. even though, it, like I said before, this wasn't meant, I don't believe, to happen there. Yeah, they plan on retaliation. They plan upon doing harm to one another. And it happens. It's like I said, it's like 1%. So in response to this, you know, in a positive note, I'm happy to report that speaking with Commissioner Robella, Connecticut State Police, he has graciously given us a couple of state troopers on each shift to work in conjunction with the Bridgeport Police Department to enhance public safety in our city.
All right, great. And finally, Chief, I'll give you the open forum here, folks listening to my show here. What would you tell people in Bridgeport who live here, who work here, who commute through here, who just like to walk the streets? A lot of them are called today and, you know, say they're a little shocked and, you know, disgusted at this, thanking God that nobody else was injured here with all those flying bullets. What would you say to those folks right now, Chief?
Like I said before, you know, we have a great police department. The men and women of the Bridgeport Police Department are dedicated to public safety, to the safety of all citizens in the city of Bridgeport. They do a fantastic job. And even though we have to worry about a number of things in life, you know, and there's no guarantees. But the one thing I can guarantee is that we are dedicated and that we are committed to public safety in the city of Bridgeport.
Bridgeport Police Chief Armando Perez. Chief, we know it's been a crazy day for you. Thanks. We appreciate it. Anytime you'd like to call in, feel free.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks. Appreciate it. All right. Armando Perez, the chief of Bridgeport there. Well, look at that. They got a bunch of the perpetrators, the perps, just joining us, but joining us right now to update us further on the situation here on Connecticut Today. Bridgeport Mayor Joe Gannon. Mayor, it's Paul here. Thanks for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Paul, thanks for having me. It's been a little bit of a tough day,
yep.
A couple of days, but I'll certainly give you an update as to what was a shooting on Golden Hill Street near the courthouse. This was not involved with the courthouse inside or anything like that, and this was not a random act. And, you know, sometimes news releases early on, so I want to clarify that. There were, I believe it's four individuals who have non-life-threatening injuries. On that end of it, and they've been certainly taken to the hospital and being treated. There are also three or maybe as many as four individuals who have been apprehended, we believe, in connection with this already by the Bridgeport Police Department. So I greatly appreciate their efforts. The City Council and I have met. We met with the state delegation. I've just recently again talked to the governor about the support that he's providing and the state police are providing. They always work well. All levels, I will tell you, in the Bridgeport area of law enforcement work well together, but especially in an incident like this, which involves a state courthouse or near a state courthouse, Bridgeport Police and the state law enforcement, state troopers, are enhancing their presence there. And the governor also said, as an adjunct to that, at our request, the troopers will again be joining Bridgeport police officers in neighborhoods throughout the city as they did through most of the summer. We found that to have very positive, not only have a positive relationship between the officers, but have a positive impact on what happens or doesn't happen in some of the streets in our neighborhood. So we welcome them. We thank them, along with the great work the Bridgeport Police Department is already doing on this. And maybe if there's any other questions, please ask me.
Sure. Yeah, Mayor. And it's got to be frustrating, as the chief just told me a couple of minutes ago. You know, there's that 98 or 99% over that of the people of Bridgeport that don't commit crimes. They just want to live good, productive lives, enjoy their neighborhoods, enjoy the place they live. But as big city mayors like yourself and the mayors of New Haven that I've interacted with over the years and up in Hartford, Luke Bronin, I recently spoke to him. It is a challenge, Mayor, is it not, when there are these small cells of individuals who have really, in this case here, we see an example, little regard for human life in the middle of a midday.
It is not, and appreciate your understanding, it is a challenge, but it's not just a challenge. It is the single largest, most significant and serious challenge that mayors of major cities, law enforcement, major urban centers in America today face. There's nothing more destructive, disturbing, devastating than the pervasive gun violence that has plagued neighborhoods and cities, especially throughout the country. I just came back from a consortium of mayors in the U.S. Conference of Mayors, which I'm an officer, and we talked about the mayor of Dayton was there, who's seen mass shootings at El Paso. You can go city to city, and everyone has, unfortunately, a story to share. But law enforcement is a huge piece of it. The gun consortium elements that we put forth, there's too many guns out in the hands of too many young people. Some of these young people, and some of these are fuels that are fueled by prior incident or a prior shooting, but they perpetuate. And we need to break that cycle. We need to provide opportunities and better support for young people. And it's a challenge that hopefully I'm up for, and other mayors, in conjunction with community groups and religious leaders, will little by little, I think, send a positive message out.
Yeah, and
we'll be doing a press conference around midday tomorrow with members of the city council with some of the things we're going to do to address youth violence in the city of Bridgeport, specifically supporting law enforcement in higher crime areas in conjunction with the Bridgeport Housing Authority and others as a way to kind of send a positive message out, but a very not just a message, but a very positive impact in all parts of the city to this, as you pointed out, very, I think, very important for people to understand, probably less than 1% of any community or the individuals that participate repeatedly in incidents like this.
Yeah, and Mayor, finally, I think you pointed out correctly that yeah, there is a gun problem, but the other layer of it, even if you take away the guns, Mayor, youth has to understand that there's a lot of anger out there for whatever, family reasons, neighborhood reasons. Taking away the guns is part A. Part B is teaching young people, listen, take a breath, step back. Fighting these constant battles in the end, it doesn't help. It's not going to get you anywhere in life.
Well, it's going to get you somewhere in life. It's either going to get you locked up for 30 years, or it's going to get you an early, unfortunately, I hate to sound so cruel, but I'm certainly upset, it's going to create an early grave. And many of them are too young to understand the significance of the easy access to being able to look at someone and pull a trigger. And it's unfortunate. So there's an educational process. There's a support mechanism. There is the nurturing of young people, too. And we're not going to lose sight of that. But at the same time, a powerful message was that you can't just pull out a gun. And for whether it's a dispute, whether it involves you or someone that you're supposedly associated with, and pull a trigger, whether it's at a car, at a window, at a building, or at a person, and not have to pay the consequences for your actions. So I greatly appreciate the opportunity. Our department is on top of it. I thank the people who listen, the listeners and the people of the city of Bridgeport for their support, as we'll continue to do everything we can, not only to make this the best city that we can, but the safest city that we can as well.
All right, Mayor, thank you. We appreciate the time. We'll be in touch. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hey, bye-bye.